listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Our guest for today's episode is Dr. Jim Nicholson, who has spent the last 10 years of his career helping to identify pregnant women who would benefit from induction before 40 weeks of gestation. Based in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and affiliated with Penn State Milton S. Hershey Medical Center, Dr. Nicholson has become increasingly concerned about the rising numbers of stillbirths in the United States and has studied the correlation between the 39-week rule and the rate of stillbirth. His research is gaining notoriety, and we are grateful he took the time to be a guest on our podcast. Well, Dr. Nicholson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I just got to say, I love acronyms, and you have quite the acronym here. It's eight letters long. It's AMORIPAT, which stands for Active Management of Risk in Pregnancy at Term. That's how the Star Legacy Foundation first learned about you, with this project and this work that you're doing and this research. Can you describe this acronym and what it means?
Sure. It's an acronym that's long and clunky, and I've tried to find a replacement for it over the years and haven't found one that really fits the project. But basically what it stands for is actively doing something about identifiable factors that pregnant women have, specifically for cesarean delivery, when they reach the term period of pregnancy, which starts at 37 weeks. So it's basically an acronym that talks about doing something about risk factors that can be identified. And the doing something that's done within the project is identifying an optimal time for delivery and then usually inducing labor when the method thinks that might be the optimal time or the best time for delivery.
Let's talk about how your focus shifted eventually to looking at the timing of delivery and stillbirth rates. What was the pivotal moment, or how did you transition into this focus area?
Sure, the actual transition was done for me. As I did a number of studies and projects and published a number of papers in the medical OB journals, I finally was able to do a small randomized clinical trial that I presented at the Maternal Fetal Medicine Conference in February of 2008. And shortly after that, I was contacted by the International Stillbirth Conference organizers that were preparing to do a conference in Oslo, Norway, on stillbirth and stillbirth prevention. And they thought that maybe the method I had talked about at the Maternal Fetal Medicine Conference might be effective at lowering stillbirth. So they invited me to come to the conference in Oslo, and I accepted and was able to give a talk. And it was at that point that I started to focus attention on the stillbirth issue as well as the cesarean section prevention issue.
So that was about a decade ago, and a lot of your work since then has focused around what we call the 39-week rule. Can you talk about what the 39-week rule is and how you became interested in the topic and why you still continue to be interested in it today?
Sure. It's somewhat of a complicated answer, but not that complicated. As I was talking in Norway in 2008, the U.S. was already, or I should say, expert talking about the need to start restricting labor induction activity and not providing what we call elective deliveries prior to 39 weeks. At that time in 2008, there was somewhat of a disagreement between many providers of OB care and the experts in the field about the optimal timing of delivery. So even in 2008, there was a movement to start to restrict induction of labor before 39 weeks of gestation. The actual decision to create and adopt that rule happened in 2010. And I was kind of caught in the middle of that. So on the one hand, I was trying to suggest that induction of labor was, in many cases, a good thing and should even be done in the late 37th or early 38th week. The movement was definitely towards not doing that. The the basic issue was I was in favor of doing more inductions, and the OB community as a whole was starting to restrict them in the U.S.
You have published some recent studies that have looked at the stillbirth rates at the end of pregnancy. Can you talk a little bit about what you have found and how your studies are different from others that look at similar data?
Sure. So coming off the answer to the last question, I was somewhat restricted in what I could do, and for 3 or 4 years after 2010, wasn't able to practice the way I wanted to and couldn't publish research the way I wanted to. But sometime around 2014, 2015, I realized that the 39-week rule had been in place for several years, that the actual methods that were being used to treat pregnant ladies throughout the country really had changed. And I was really, I think, one of the first to think that maybe we could look at data from all the states around the U.S. to see what actually had happened to term stillbirth rates as the change in practice occurred. And we actually did a fairly simple study with residents from the Penn State Hershey Family Medicine Program. We simply called all the states up in the U.S. and asked them for simple data, the number of births they'd had each year between 2007 and 2013. And then also we asked for the number of term stillbirths they had in each of those years. And we got data from all but, I think, three states, and were able to show that during the 7-year period that we were studying, there was a definite change of practice. So fewer and fewer babies were being born before 39 weeks, as you'd expect with a 39-week rule. But at the same time, there was a significant but subtle but significant increase in the rate of term stillbirth. The paper was accepted by the Maternal Fetal Medicine Conference, and I was able to present that at the conference, stating very clearly that this was a retrospective study, and you can't claim that there's a direct connection between the adoption of the 39-week rule and the increase in term stillbirth rate. However, the science of pregnancy and the knowledge that term stillbirth risk increases as you go higher and higher through the term period, in other words, increasing gestational age, it made sense that if you're making thousands and thousands of women gestate longer because of the 39-week rule, that there would be a higher rate of term stillbirth. So that's what the paper was, and it was published in a major journal in the spring of 2016.
I know that the work that you do is viewed as heroic by certain people and controversial by others. And so my next question revolves around the controversy. You know, we see time and time again that whenever policies or laws determine medical decisions, it's often met with controversy, even when they're well-intentioned or evidence-based. So in your opinion, why is there so much controversy regarding the timing of delivery and the 39-week rule?
Sure, really good question. I think a large part of the controversy deals with the fact that many people honestly believe in a very strong way that that labor and delivery and childbirth should be as natural as possible, that nature knows best, and that we would be much better off if we do as little medically to intervene on a pregnancy as possible. And the method of care that I've been working on and describing is somewhat the opposite of that. It has a fairly high intervention rate, bringing women into the hospital, inducing their labor. So the two things really are opposed to each other. It's further complicated by the fact that there were many, many studies back 20, 30, 15 years ago that were done in a way that showed that labor induction led to higher rates of things like C-sections, cesarean deliveries, higher rates of intensive care unit admission. Also, there were studies done that showed that babies born in the 37th and 38th week of gestation weren't as healthy as babies born 39 weeks and after that. So there was some scientific suggestion that In fact, we should let things alone, not induce before 39 weeks. However, it's now fairly clear in the medical literature, with many experts weighing in, that those earlier studies had a lot of problems and a lot of things which meant that you couldn't take their results as an indication of causality, or in other words, saying that induction was necessarily bad, or that delivery in the 37th or 38th was week of gestation was necessarily bad. But in any case, there was a very strong development of belief in the 39-week rule. There were many national health organizations that endorsed the rule that March of Dimes did. A number of patient advocacy organizations did, and certainly the professional organizations like ACOG and the American Academy of Family Medicine weighed in thinking that this rule was a good idea. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there's been an increasing amount of evidence suggesting that, in fact, induction of labor versus waiting till later, which is the other choice you have if you don't induce labor, that, in fact, labor induction lowers section rates and, in fact, lowers stillbirth rates. So that evidence is there, and there have been studies. In fact, a very recent study that was just announced one month ago, showing that induction of labor at 39 weeks as compared to waiting till later lowers cesarean delivery rates and probably lowers things like hypertension and pregnancy rates, and may even lower adverse outcomes for the babies involved. Despite the more recent research, though, there's still this very, very strong belief that we should be as natural as possible, and most providers and most organizations are continuing to want to be that way and therefore endorse the 39-week rule. My frustration with that is that if you really look at this issue from a scientific basis without the politics, I think it's fairly clear that we should revise our thinking, but that kind of revision occurs very slowly in the medical field and very slowly in the field of OB. I'd add that the ACOG, the major OB organization, is going to be looking at especially this recent study that just came out, and I'm hoping there will be some changes to the idea that induction is not a good intervention, but I don't think they will be questioning at this point whether the 39-week rule should be reconsidered.
So my next question for you is, what motivates you to keep going? Because as you mentioned, there are frustrations. The process has been slow in terms of changing the thinking and changing the acceptance levels to what you're doing. And it may seem like an entire lifetime to get the medical community to change its way of thinking. So what does motivate you to keep going?
So sure. I will tell you it's not easy, but on the other hand, I have a few things that motivate me. One is my long experience with the active management style of care that I talked about previously. I've had delivery of hundreds of ladies under that system, and the outcomes have been generally not just a little bit better than usual, but significantly better than usual. I say the second thing is my ongoing care of patients. As I'm taking care of prenatal patients, I continue to talk about the method and offer the method, and people generally accept it. And as I'm delivering patients here at the Hershey Medical Center, they continue to do very well with a very low section rate and a very healthy baby outcome profile. So that continues to be a motivation. And then I think the third is ongoing care for people that I will be caring for. I want to be able to continue to push this method because I really have seen it be effective. The work I've done with Star Legacy and the stillbirth issue is probably the most compelling reason for me to continue, because I truly believe that a greater use of labor induction in a careful, patient-oriented way that involves patient choice rather than doctors telling people they must be induced will not only improve outcomes, but will prevent cases of stillbirth. one of the strange things about prevention or preventive approaches to anything is if you prevent something, you never see it. So it's hard to be showing people that as you're doing a certain method of care that you're preventing anything. But as we're standing back and looking at, for example, the rates of term stillbirth in the USA over the past 7, 8, 9 years, we are seeing that there definitely are trends that are consistent with increases in the term stillbirth rate. And I'd add that there was a study that came out a year ago presented at the Maternal Fetal Medicine Conference, which confirmed the work I did using national birth certificate stillbirth data, saying, yep, there's been an increase. And again, my motivation is that as I'm working in the year 2018 in a major medical center where we ought to be really focusing on not only keeping our outcomes the same but improving them, I'm very frustrated that this major outcome called term stillbirth is actually occurring with increasing frequency in the USA. It should be going down. And I think that the greater use of labor induction is clearly one method that I think has the potential to do that. So again, that's one of my major driving motivations to keep at this.
So as a national organization, the Star Legacy Foundation talks to families all over the country who have experienced pregnancy loss. And it appears, based on our anecdotal conversations, that there is wide variation in how these policies are implemented. There's a patchwork. Is that part of the problem, or do you think the fact that there's wide variation is a good thing?
Well, I think it's a good thing in that there are some centers that are doing more induction than others, and I'm hoping that those that do more are able to show that their outcomes are better. I think it also provides the opportunity for people to do some shopping around, if you will. In other words, if your provider is going, if you're a patient who wants an induction of labor and your current provider is not in favor of that at all until, say, a week or a week and a half past the due date, the fact that different providers work differently gives the option of maybe looking for one that would be more lenient in that regard. But I will add that all hospitals in the USA now are not very lenient about breaking the 39-week rule. That's fairly strictly applied almost everywhere, although there are some providers that are developing more and more indications or reasons that they can break it. But those institutions are fairly few and far between. So there is some variation. I think the variation exists more not with breaking the 39-week rule, but being willing to induce at 39 weeks rather than waiting until 41 or 41 and a half weeks. One of the interesting things about the stillbirth study that I did is that we were able to show that actually providers are, with decreasing frequency, letting people go till a week, week and a half past the due date. So I think that's a good thing. The variation there is also a good thing, and I'm hoping that more and more providers will at least be inducing at 39 weeks rather than waiting till 41. We're never going to have everybody practicing exactly the same, so there will always be some natural variation.
So to your knowledge, are there consequences for a doctor who breaks the 39-week rule, and what is the process for them to make that happen?
So at this point, there are not penalties for physicians, although if they were to really go outside usual methods and start an induction, for example, outpatient, so that the patient had to be delivered in a hospital before 39 weeks, he or she would probably be reprimanded in some way, shape, or form, either through his or her hospital or through the state licensing board. The larger penalty comes from organizations that supervise hospitals. The Joint Commission, for example, supervises all hospitals for quality. And if they find that hospitals are allowing induction of labor or cesarean delivery for no, quote, good reason or no established indication, if they find that out, they will criticize that institution and penalize it in a number of ways. Most institutions don't want to even think about that happening, so there are fairly strict rules that almost all labor and delivery units have that prevent non-indicated induction prior to 39 weeks.
Does the 39-week rule exist in any other country other than the U.S.?
I'm not aware of a strict rule like the 39-week in other countries. Many countries have traditionally followed the USA in terms of what policy is, but this is somewhat of an exception. When I was at the stillbirth conference in Amsterdam back in 2014, I had a fair amount of pushback from providers in Europe anyway who were saying it's not possible that USA providers could be so restricted, and there were several American doctors there that supported me in saying, oh yes, there is this strict rule. And I've had recent conversations with other providers from around the world, especially in Europe, saying no, there's no other country that's currently having this level of restriction. There still is the recommendation to be careful about inducing prior to 39 weeks, but there isn't a strict rule that's imposed like there is in the U.S.
So is it a safe summation of what you're saying to say that other countries view the U.S. as a model, and they look up to the U.S. when it comes to medicine practices, but the 39-week rule is kind of an outlier to that, where they're not following our lead?
I think that's a fair description of what's going on.
Are there women and families who should be more concerned about the 39-week policies than others?
Yeah, I think my answer to that would be yes. There's certainly I would be more concerned about any patient that had had a prior a term stillbirth, especially patients with significant obesity, very high BMIs, or patients that are past the age of 35 are at increased risk for stillbirth. I worry more about them in terms of term stillbirth risk than I do about folks that are more completely normal. Another group which has been studied in Europe and somewhat in the U.S. are African-American patients, and for some reason they seem to have an optimal time of delivery that's about a week before Caucasian patients. We're not sure why that is, but their risk of stillbirth is higher. In my work in Philadelphia, when I was doing studies, I found that 38 and a half weeks was an ideal time for delivery for African American patients there, but that certainly isn't an exception or an indication for breaking the 39-week rule now in the USA. But rates of adverse outcomes in the term period of birth for African Americans is clearly higher than for Caucasians, and that's another group that I would be more concerned about when we talk about the 39-week rule.
So it's my understanding that some congratulations are in order, because your paper recently won an award for being a top cited paper. Now, I don't understand the world of research, but I'm assuming that's kind of like winning an Emmy?
I guess a little bit. It's interesting. I just had a knock on my door. They literally just brought the certificate that was in the mail today. But this was an award from the stillbirth paper that was published 2 years ago, and there was an award given at the most recent Maternal Fetal Medicine conference for a highly cited paper. I don't think it was an award for the most highly cited paper, but it was an indication that the paper has been highly cited. So people have been reading it, talking about it. Again, I think there's movement in the country to be, generally speaking, inducing sooner in the term period than waiting until 41 or 42 weeks. My frustration with the paper or the award is that the key point of the paper really hasn't been useful. In other words, there's not a large conversation going on about should we modify the 39-week rule, should we lower the limit to 38 or 38 and a half, or should we be more willing to look for indications. Again, the paper basically said that with the adoption of this rule, the term stillbirth rate went up, and there may be a link. And if there is a link, we should be concerned about that, and we should be doing what we think we might be able to do to address that. And again, despite the paper apparently being fairly highly read and cited by other papers, it hasn't had the impact that I hoped it would. But as I said earlier in our conversation, things move slowly in the world of medical science and OB obstetrics, and I'm hoping that that conversation will be happening. I do hope to be doing some follow-up studies of the term stillbirth paper. There now are three additional years that could be looked at. I think everyone is now more aware of the impact of increasing gestational age on what's called cumulative term stillbirth risk. So I'm hopeful that the 39-week rule is going to be modified at some point in the near future.
Let's dream for a second here. Pretend that you're retired and you're looking back on your career. What is your picture of success? In a perfect world, what would you like to look back and say, wow, we made a lot of strides, we made a lot of accomplishments. What would you like the world of pregnancies in the U.S. to look like when you retire, looking back on your career?
Sure. Very interesting question. For me, success would be to hear that there would be a number of large medical centers, OB departments, if you will, that had picked up the idea of what I described earlier, which is active management, looking at patients on an individual basis based on their own personal set of risk factors and trying to determine the ideal time for delivery. That necessitates the more regular need for or use of labor induction so that people deliver at what I think can be described as the optimal time of delivery, but coupled with an attitude where the wishes and the beliefs of the pregnant women are held in a higher regard so that there's a choice and discussion going on with the provider and with the patient to determine the optimal timing of delivery. And then hopefully larger studies that are done to show that actually there's benefit to that and that the outcomes are better. It's not just a matter of jumping from here to everybody changing practice. There's a set of steps that have to occur, and more institutions need to look at it and study it. So that would be my hope, is that this concept would be picked up by more than a few institutions and studied in a way that's scientifically correct and valid and with results that will tell us. I continue to say that perhaps the methods I'm using may not be correct, although I think they are. They may not be correct for everyone, or every provider, and there may be some providers that are better at doing this active management than others, and that needs to be addressed and realized. But I think there also are a lot of providers that could take this method and do extremely well with it. I had a group in Italy that I worked with that picked up the method and had unusually good outcomes, an extremely low section rate, extremely healthy baby population, no term stillbirths in the group they worked with over a two-year period. But that group, unfortunately, was closed down in terms of their induction activity because it was not consistent with what the USA was doing. But my hope would be there would be other groups that would pick it up and try it and show that it's beneficial.
Well, Dr. Nicholson, this has been a fascinating and inspiring conversation. Thank you for taking the time to appear on the podcast.
Well, thank you for giving me a chance to talk about it, and I wish you the best of luck.
That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.